Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. On September 22, 2025, Francesca Wade spoke with Bio member Natalie Dykstra on Zoom to talk about her latest biography, Gertrude Stein, An Afterlife, which was published by Scribner in October 2025.
Many congratulations on this astonishing accomplishment of this book, Gertrude Stein, An Afterlife. I really can't stop thinking and talking about it, so I'm so pleased to have the chance to talk with you and to have you join us at Bio for this interview. I'd like to go a little bit in a circle to follow Stein in her wonderful circles by starting with her extraordinary body of writing and ending our conversation there. But before that, can you give us just a little bit of an arc of her life, when and where she was born, where she was educated, when did she first move to Paris, so we can kind of locate her time?
Yeah, she's such an American figure in a way, and yet she spent almost all of her life outside of America, defining herself and her kind of artistic accomplishments outside, but very much in relation to her her home country. She was born in 1874 in Philadelphia, although moved to Europe actually at a very young age and had a sort of European childhood. So I guess in a way her most formative early non-memories would have been of Vienna and even of Paris. But she moved back to Oakland when she was about five, and so that's where she really grew up. Her parents both died when she was a teenager, which was a sort of trauma she didn't really want to discuss or go into, which is a sort of a shying away from serious matters that kind of characterized her outwardly throughout her life. And she followed her brother Leo off to Harvard. She enrolled as one of the first women students at the Harvard Annex, which became Radcliffe. And that's where she studied under William James in his very pioneering psychological laboratory. And he encouraged her to pursue medical studies with a view to kind of pursuing psychology or a medical career, and she went off to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. So there's this sort of alternative life in which Stein could have been, you know, quite a trailblazing, you know, female physician, but she abandoned that path, although, as we might discuss, I think it was very kind of important and crucial to what she went on to do. She left America in 1903. And moved to Paris, which is where her brother Leo had just set up a home and started at art school. And she didn't return to America for 30 years after that. And she came back to be absolutely lionized as the best-selling author of the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, which I think no one might have predicted when she left Baltimore in 1903.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. So you start the book with one of my favorite lines ever of a book. You write, she came to Paris, she said, to kill the 19th century. So here it was, you cleave it, first part of her life, her work life. So can you tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, I love the next line too. Her weapons were a pencil and a supply of soft cover notebooks, her targets, dullness and cliché.
She often sort of uses kind of phrasing like that. She makes a big distinction between the 19th century and the 20th. She later, and I sort of go on in the at the start of the book to talk about them, her sitting for Picasso's portrait, which was another very kind of emblematic moment that she often used to refer to when she was talking about herself and her literary achievements. And she describes that portrait as being Picasso's kind of move from the sort of 19th century style of representation into the distortions and, you know, modernity of cubism. And she writes later that while she was sitting for him, she was thinking in her head and writing in her mind the sentences which would make up the stories of three lives. And she says that that book was the first definite step out of the 19th century and into the 20th in literature. So she liked this idea that she was, that her work marked a rupture, and indeed her move to Paris, you know, marked a leaving behind of something and a creation of something new. And I think the 19th century could signify lots of different things to her. I mean, in a way, she came out of the 19th century and she loved 19th century literature. Another part of her sort of self-mythology is the amount of reading she did. And she dropped out of school pretty much as a teenager after her mother had died and spent her days in the San Francisco Mechanics Library, reading her way through the 19th century, and before. And she claimed she'd read, the entirety of English literature. And both William and Henry James, I think, were very kind of important to her. But I think she came to associate the 19th century with a kind of decorum and maybe a realism and a sense of progress and kind of linear development and a belief in things like evolution, and sort of stability that I think she wanted to completely upend. And I think for her, 20th century meant modern and surprising and fresh and cutting through everything that had come before. And she never really wrote or engaged with Freud, although it's possible he was more important to her than she let on. But I think she was so interested in the sort of internal, what goes on kind of inside the mind, and the processes of perception. And I think that came out of her studies with William James. And so I think that was something to do with the kind of newness that she wanted to explore in her 20th century work.
Oh, that's fantastic. The Picasso portrait was painted. When was the date?
1905, he started it, and then the story goes that he was struggling so much to draw her face and had to keep scrubbing it out, and eventually he disappeared for 6 months, and when he came back, he presented it to her, and everyone, people said, but she doesn't look like it, and he replied, she will.
And of course, he was prescient. She did. She
Yes,
did. Which comes from his own
definitely.
book.
Yeah, and that portrait became so much a marker of her identity. She would sit under it. She would hang it on the wall so that, people who came to see her, I think, would look up and they would see her double. There's the person in front of you, but there's also the legend, the immortal. In her will, when she died, she didn't specify anything to happen to the rest of her art collection, but the Picasso portrait she left to the Metropolitan Museum in New York. And I think that was very much with the idea that her place and Picasso's place and the portrait that linked them together
They
forever
were.
would should sit among the masterpieces of Western civilization. I think it was a pointed move.
Early in her writing career, you write that life and writing were becoming one shared enterprise. I love that phrase that you used. And then you later quote Stein, "Facts of life make literature." Can you say a little more about this and how her life intertwined with writing and her writing with life? And I realize too, there's no way to talk about this without talking also about Alice B. Toklas, her beloved life partner from when they met in early in Paris to when Stein died in 1946.
Yeah, I guess there's just so many layers and so many ways of thinking about the relationship of Stein's writing to life. I mean, she became so famous for writing an autobiography, which the very title, The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, kind of promises a verisimilitude and a relationship to the events of life, which to some extent the book plays on and challenges by narrating, in a simple linear fashion, the story of a life, but it's not the life that the title would suggest it's going to be, because it's actually really the story of Gertrude Stein as projected through the eyes of the audience that she always imagined. And so even, the cover of that book, which is, well, the original cover was the photograph by Man Ray of Stein sitting writing at her desk and Toklas standing in the doorway, kind of signals to the reader with a bit of a wink that identities are going to be merged and blurred here. And there is no singular subject for this book. And I think that's something that I guess I wanted to try and sort of echo that in my book. There's no way of writing a biography of Gertrude Stein without it also being a biography of Alice
Yes,
Toklas.
I came to think that this is actually a dual biography in a certain way.
Yeah, I could have put Toklas in the title, but in a way, she wouldn't
No,
have wanted
no.
to be in the title. Stein would have wanted that, so it feels fitting that she should take the limelight. But that Toklas is, you can't read the book without seeing that Toklas is absolutely there, in everything she does. And I think that's a real deeper relationship between life and writing for Stein. I think that her writing was what she did. And this is why, I guess, often in Stein's life and the legend has become so enormous that that's what people tend to think of when they think about Stein. It's the sort of stuff surrounding her and the anecdotes. And it's all, you know, it's these totally beguiling stories, you know, the salons and the witty one-liners and the company she kept and, you know, the kind of fabulousness of everything, of the way she presented herself. But in a way, that's not the real Stein. And I think, you know, often in biographies, you know, the actual writing and the writing process, you know, how she actually spent her time was solitude and concentration and sitting at her desk, and Toklas would be the only witness to that. And so much of their relationship, I came to see, really lay in their everyday sort of intimate domesticity, which revolved around Stein's writing, the passing of manuscripts between them, you know, Stein on her own in one room writing, Toklas in another room, either asleep because it was late at night, or typing, sending notes, you know, constructing a life together out of the art that they were making between them, you know, Stein doing the writing and Toklas creating the conditions, and that's at one point, literally, or at multiple points, literally being the one who, you know, who negotiated with printers and publishers and brought it into the world. And that writing process for Stein is so related to her surroundings and to life, not in the sense that her work is exactly autobiographical always, because it doesn't necessarily aim to tell a story or to let us in on anything in a kind of confessional way, but it's going back to that idea of sort of process. I think in a way her writing is the most autobiographical in a sense, because she's conveying exactly what's going on in her head at any one moment, and the impressions that she's physically taking in from her surroundings, from the moods and thoughts that kind of dart into her brain from the way that her neurons are firing. It's those processes of living, the kind of intellectual posing of questioning of questions, sorting through ideas, you know, flitting from one idea to another, that she wanted to capture on the page. And I think that's what she meant when she said facts of life make literature.
I got completely fascinated by how you described what Stein was up to with individual words, that she started to see words as living entities with physical properties, you say, like materials a painter or sculptor might take on and shape into something new. That was such a vivid way to describe her project and gave the reader a way to kind of understand the confusion, right? That she's not making meaning through a narrative line that moves across time, but she's making a meaning through these pools of time, circular
Exactly.
time.
I think this is one of the biggest challenges and, you know, and sort of excitements of the book, was finding ways to write about Stein's writing. And I knew from early on that I wanted, you know, the book to try and, you know, to take her seriously as a writer and try and present the pleasures that I've had in reading Stein, which, you know, which didn't necessarily come naturally from the beginning, because her writing, you know, as critics throughout time have said, and this is, you know, the story of her reception is something I chart in some detail in the book, because her writing has always inspired the most hostile, you know, often hilarious reactions, and yet she's also inspired extremely devoted followers, not only the people who sort of rallied around and supported her in her lifetime, but later the kind of artists, you know, musicians and dancers, poets much later after she died, who saw the possibilities in her work and picked it up. And so, yeah, I knew that sort of a mission of the book would be to try and convey what Stein was doing, but it's hard because she resisted explanation. She would say that a composition should stand on its own, and explanation would kill it dead, because it was all about conveying the kind of fleetingness of the present moment. Although, yeah, later, after the success of the autobiography, she was invited to tour America on a, you know, big sort of lecture circuit, and she did at that point take up the opportunity to appear in front of audiences and sort of account for herself. And her lectures, I think, is a really fascinating introduction actually to what Stein was doing with words.
And she's sort of undoing grammar. I just wanted to talk a little bit, if we could, about her relationship to art. It seems so essential. It's not tangential. It's of a piece. So I just would love to hear you talk about relation of Stein and art, words and images, lines on the page and lines on the canvas, because it was so evocative in your text.
soon after she arrived in Paris, you know, she and Leo had this windfall of money from inheritance that their older brother Michael had kind of invested very shrewdly in the San Francisco first cable car industry and then in rental apartments that he had built up. And so, thanks to his business acumen, Stein and her brother had had a bit of money to kind of do what they liked with. And they were quite young, arriving in Paris, you know, excited to see what they could do. And they started buying art for their really, really just to decorate their walls, and then for the fun of getting to know artists. And that's how Stein met Picasso, you know, who was very young and had really just recently arrived in Paris. And was in her early notebooks, Stein, you know, writes a lot about Picasso and compares the kind of trajectories that they're on and the ways that they're both thinking about sort of form and space. And they both together spent a long time staring at this Cezanne portrait of his wife, which was among the first paintings that Gertrude and Leo had bought. And Stein said later that it was Cezanne who really showed her the kind of possibilities of use of an expanse of space. And I think Stein often thought of her texts as spatial, and was interested in, you know, the ways that she could kind of fill out that space, you know, with words, you know, almost like Cezanne fills a canvas, you know, with no one focal point at the center, she felt, but, you know, somehow magically the whole thing comprised a sort of perfect whole. And I think that's something that she wanted to attempt with words, you know, to put words together, yeah, not to build towards a climax, but to kind of fill out and expand and to, you know, put words together based on the way that they kind of sounded or even looked, or following a sort of internal association that would build up in a sort of cubist style, to not look to create a direct likeness or representation of something, but to evoke it in kind of in the round through a sort of penetration to what she saw as the kind of essence of the thing. It's hard to describe it really, because it's a sort of abstract and kind of indefinable impulse. And I think Stein's work, in a way, is one long inquiry into the possibilities of using language. She's more like a philosopher of language in a way than a conventional kind of author. What she's doing with the novel, for example, is nothing like what we really think of as the novel. She's tearing it apart and trying to build it, with The Making of Americans, for example, into an all-encompassing inquiry of the whole of human existence. And with her sort of poetry, she's not sort of conforming to stanzas and line breaks. She's using words outside of the constraints of grammar to set them free. I think this is another thing to do with the 19th century. She felt words had become stale because they've been used so many times before in so many contexts, that when we use certain words, you know, it's like we don't need to think about them because they don't mean anything in themselves, because they connote things outside of themselves, you know, because our brains make the associations with every time we've heard the word before. And she wanted to sort of short circuit that process, and she wanted her reader to be very much right in the moment with her. And so that's why she tried to, you know, cut us up short by using words as they'd never been used before. But also, I think, to play with all of the possible meanings of a word and kind of expand, you know, like a sponge, to sort of screw it up and then expand it out and take more in. She believed that she was doing something incredibly new and ambitious and exciting and important, with kind of far-reaching implications, and yet no one else seemed to think so.
There was some early good reviews, like Edmund Wilson was American critic. Edmund Wilson understood her. I remember that essay so well. And I would just love to hear a few more things about the reception to Stein's work, both negative and positive.
In a way, the book is kind of the story of her reception, and its peaks and troughs are so telling. I mean, she attracted some of the most kind of vitriolic reviews you can imagine. They're all in scrapbooks in the Beinecke Library. I mean, each book has its kind of folder of reviews. And often you can tell that the person hasn't read the book, and it's really a review of Stein, or, you know, a chance to just reiterate that there's this sort of mad woman in Paris who wears corduroy robes and, you know, writes nonsense. The parodies started to come out around the time of Tender Buttons, and they're not always that funny, because Stein is hard to parody and, well, sort of very easy to parody, but entirely impossible to emulate sort of accurately. And in fact, she wrote some rather tart letters to Life magazine, who I think it was, who'd published some kind of spoof works saying, you know, these are neither as funny nor as, you know, as interesting as the real thing. And I'm attaching, you know, some poems and I expect to be paid for them. And she did have some critics like Edmund Wilson and Marianne Moore, who really got it from early on and wrote some very perceptive pieces and sort of met her on her terms, I guess. And then she also had huge attacks. I mean, Wyndham Lewis, for example, absolutely went after her totally homophobic, you know, misogynist, anti-Semitic ways. I mean, those are always the undertones to the attacks on her, actually. It's not always very subtle. Even T.S. Eliot, who never, you know, was never quite quite sure about her. Yeah, this has characterized her reception absolutely from the start, this kind of bemused approach. And yet she's always had people who were interested and supported her and wanted to know more, often kind of younger men, usually gay men. There's a whole kind of series of these men who I've, you know, whose stories I loved researching, because they're often slightly sort of misfits, sort of eccentrics off in America, who sometimes engaged Stein, you know, in correspondence, or saw her as, you know, as a sort of mother figure or kind of a
Yes.
guru, and were excited by what she was doing and saw its potential. And I think it's that sort of strand of her reception. It's often on a pretty individual kind of personal level that I think has carried her work through and carried it on into the 50s and 60s. I mean, Frank O'Hara wrote his undergraduate dissertation on Stein. You know, John Ashbery, some of his early reviews were of the reissues of her works in the 50s. Yeah, and by that point, the bad reviews that she'd had earlier in her career, you know, became almost like a status symbol that she was marginal and misunderstood, and that only made her more interesting. But I think they did sting her a lot, and she was sanguine about it to some extent. She did eventually give this lecture in 1926 called Composition as Explanation, where she laid out her sort of theory of the avant-garde, that that work that is, you know, truly boundary breaking won't be appreciated in its own time, but we have to trust that times will catch up. And I think that goes for so many aspects of Stein, you know, her sexuality as well, not only the avant-garde work, that it wasn't until much later that, in a way, her reputation was really bolstered in probably the 70s and 80s, when she was somewhat reclaimed as a kind of queer icon, kind of lesbian hero, which was an aspect of her work which was really not discussed in her lifetime.
There's a wonderful phrase of Stein's, as you say, scattered across her work. Quote, "When this you see, remember me." It's a phrase that captures so movingly Stein's deep wish to be understood, reckoned with, and seen. She prepared for this afterlife by helping assemble her own archive at Yale, which she sent to the Beinecke Library at Yale. Can you tell us a little bit more about this archive, how it set the stage for her afterlife, and also then your work in the archive?
I think it was really after the American tour when Stein came back to Paris and kind of saw that, you know, that in a way her fame was at its highest point, and yet still, you know, she'd hoped that the autobiography, with its huge sales, would mean publishers would want to take on, you know, reissues and, or, you know, bring out new volumes of the work, the manuscripts that, you know, Toklas had lovingly filed away in a cabinet, you know, widely rejected by magazines and publishers, but they didn't. And I think at this point, her friend Thornton Wilder had been approached by the Yale Library. They'd asked him to kind of to ask Stein on their behalf whether she would consider donating her papers to the collection that they were starting to establish. And I think that at this point, she really did start to see a kind of posthumous existence, and I think was quite edified by the prospect that even if she couldn't find work, find publishers and readers in the moment for her work, there would be the possibility with an archive that that work could be recovered in the future, you know, by people who she couldn't even imagine. She wanted her work to have a life of its own. She knew that, you know, that culture could only come about in a way if people had a past to look back to. And so, you know, presenting or preserving the work would be almost, yeah, like a sort of investment in the creation of that future. But it's, yeah, it's a hard thing to imagine, especially when than, the odds seemed to be against her. But she created this enormous archive and she had saved everything. So off went the manuscripts, and the war was looming. And so she, I think, piled stuff in something of a hurry. And that was another aspect, I guess, that it was seemed a prudent thing to get the, the property out of France and into a, safe container in the US. After she died, Toklas continued sending material over. And so the library's collection is one of the most sort of comprehensive archives that the Beinecke has, really, because Stein was so meticulous in keeping things. And when she knew that she was curating an archive, she and the Yale librarian sort of wrote around to a lot of the friends who might have, letters from her and things, and tried to kind of augment the collection. And in fact, Donald Gallup, the curator at Yale, who was in charge of cataloguing the Stein collection, becomes a major character in the second half of my book, because his work very quickly threw up all kinds of, ethical complex dilemmas, of the kind that all biographers are well familiar with, what to do when material, very private material turns up in the archive that may prove distressing to a surviving relative. And in this case, Toklas, who had been such a kind of shadowy figure in Stein's lifetime, to the outside, it seemed like, their relationship was almost a caricature. Stein so domineering, Toklas so quiet and subservient and obsequious. And I think something the archive really shows is actually, how tender and sort of collaborative their dynamic really was behind closed doors. And I think there was a lot of theatricality in the way they wanted to project their relationship, all to bolster the image of Stein as this genius, complete with adoring wife, which was all, part of the kind of subversive play that they were putting out. But left alone, and she survived for 20 years after Stein, Toklas had to, not only work out who she was without the partner who had been her entire life, but also had to sort of transfer that devotion to Stein's memory and work out how she wanted to carry out the task that Stein had assigned her, which was to do everything she could to steward that legacy and make sure that as much of Stein's work as possible could be made available to the public. And I guess there's sort of two strands to what Toklas had to do. On the one hand, there was the publication program, and Stein had left her money and instructions in her will, that she wanted every word she'd written to be published. And so Toklas, along with Stein's friend Carl van Vechten, were tasked with finding a publisher who would be willing to take on an edition of Stein's collected works, and if not, to fund it themselves by selling off paintings. But the other, perhaps, more complex and aspect of Toklas's new role was dealing with biographers, and the archive was opened up, of course, and very quickly, all kinds of people came to look at it with all kinds of motives and preconceptions and agendas. And I think it was a bit of a shock to Toklas to sort of realize that, now Stein was in a way public property and was taking on this life of her own, and that people could write about her however they wanted, and they could see, they might well see different things in the work and the life to the ones that Toklas saw and remembered, and they might have archival material to back up interpretations, or revelations that, were rather at odds with the story or narrative of Stein's life that Toklas wanted to project. As a biographer, I've always been so fascinated by the work that the biographer does and the way that we, shape the narratives. And, I had known firsthand from writing my first book about all of the sort of mechanics of, what material gets saved, how much the story of someone's life can vary depending on whether someone has saved a lot of papers or has saved a very partial set of papers or has cooperated with biographers or not, or has had an estate who's been supportive or not. And so I guess, yeah, I found it so kind of exciting to try and sort of lay bare that process using kind of first Stein and then Toklas as a way into exploring that process as it played out over the next 20 years after Stein's death.
Thank you so much, Francesca, for this really extraordinary biography and talking with me and with our bio listeners.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Francesca Wade talking with bio member Natalie Dykstra about her book Gertrude Stein, An Afterlife, published by Scribner in October 2025. This interview was recorded on Zoom on September 22nd, 2025. To learn more about bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Sonia Williams is our executive producer. Darren Nesblid created our theme music. Until next time, thanks for listening.